It's a very beautiful festival. Many of you have seen already. Those who didn't see will have the chance to see Krishna dressed in so many different veshas, different costumes, depicting different pastimes. So for the next 21 days, besides the decoration of Chandan, besides the boat festival in the afternoon, we have these veshas, which is a special feature of this festival. So today, we don't have a shloka from the Bhagavatam on the board, we don't have a board. We're going to speak a little bit about Chandan Yatra, beginning of Chandan Yatra in this day of Akshaya Tritiya. Chandan Yatra, beginning of Chandan Yatra in this day of Akshaya Tritiya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Mukam karoti vachalam pangum langhayate girin yat kripatam aham vande shri gurum dinataranam paramananda madhavam shri chaitanya ishvaram.
So why do we celebrate this Chandan Yatra? What's the purpose behind decorating the Lord with Chandan and dressing the Lord in so many different costumes every day? It's a lot of work. That's one of the reasons why the timing is even changed. We have the class now, 7 o'clock, and 8 o'clock we have darshan, which gives the pujaris a little more time to prepare the altar, to decorate the deities with the special dresses. So, why is it? No? Why do we put different veshas in the deities? I was thinking about that and came to mind a shloka that says, Smartavya satatam Vishnu vismartavyo najato chit sarve vidhi nishedasyu etayor eva kinkara. All the rules and regulations of Shastra, all that we do in devotional service is for the sake of remembering Krishna always and never forgetting Him. So, how does that help us to remember Krishna? So, we have Krishna being dressed one day as Natavara, the best of dancers. We have Krishna being dressed another day as Govardhan Dari. And another day He comes with the Nauka Lila, the boat pastime. And another day He comes as Lord Ramachandra. And another day He comes as Lord Nrisimhadev. And like that, every day when we take darshana, we will see Krishna dressed in a special way to remind us of a particular pastime. It's very limited. It's only 21 days and Krishna has unlimited pastimes. But this gives us the opportunity to remember those pastimes. Of course, if someone never heard Krishna's pastimes and happens to come to Mayapur and go there and take darshan, that person may not understand so much. Why is Krishna dressed with some strange beard like a lion? Or why is Krishna there sitting in a boat? What is he doing? Doesn't mean much for someone who didn't hear Krishna's pastimes enough. But if someone has heard the pastimes, if someone is familiar with those activities of the Lord, then when they see, they just take darshan and they can see so much. Because actually, as Prabhupada explains, we see Krishna through the ears more than through the eyes. So only for those who have heard about Krishna, who have learned about His pastimes, when they see, they can see so much. They see more than what is actually there, because just by seeing, by having a glimpse of the Lord dressed in a particular way, they remember so many activities connected to that particular dress. So by hearing, by thinking about Krishna, by serving Krishna, by performing devotional service in different ways, that is what qualifies us to actually see Krishna. Those devotees who are directly engaged there, for example, preparing the veshas, no? Making all the decorations, making all the arrangements for putting the altar, for dressing Krishna, they have to think all the little details about how Krishna is dressed, and they have to read the scriptures again and again, try to find out more and more details and prepare all the ornaments. So when they see a lot. So that's the point I would like to emphasize today, is the importance of actually hearing about Krishna, speaking about Krishna, remembering Krishna, preaching about Krishna. So that process of Shravana and Kirtana is extremely powerful, and that will enable us to see Krishna. So to start to develop more this topic, I chose one verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, which is spoken by Queen Kunti. I read the verse. First, Queen Kunti, she is speaking about the reasons why Krishna appears. And she says, Krishna, it's very bewildering that you come to this world and you enact so many pastimes, because actually you are ajasya, you have no birth. You don't need to take birth. And you are akartu. You don't have to do anything. But still you take birth so many times, and still you execute so many pastimes, so many activities. So that's very bewildering. Why do you do that? So she starts answering to her own question, and she gives different reasons. She says, some say that the unborn is born for the glorification of pious kings, and others say that he's born to please King Yadu, one of your dearest devotees. You appear in his family as sandalwood appears in the Malaya hills. She goes on saying, others say that since both Vasudeva and Devaki prayed for you, you have taken your birth as their son. Undoubtedly, you are unborn, yet you take your birth for their welfare and to kill those who are envious of the demigods. Others say that the world being overburdened, like a boat at sea, is much aggrieved, and that Brahma, who is your son, prayed for you, and so you have appeared to diminish the trouble. And then she gives a final reason, which is very interesting. She says, Bhavesmin klishamana anam avidya karma karma bi shravana smarana arhani karishan iti kechana. And yet others say that you appear to rejuvenate the devotional service of hearing, remembering, worshipping, and so on, in order that the conditioned souls suffering from material pains might take advantage and gain liberation. So the final reason she gives is that Krishna actually comes to this world. He takes birth and he enacts unlimited pastimes just to attract us back to the spiritual world. He comes here to act in such a way, in such a wonderful ways, that when we hear about him, we desire to be again with him. We desire to join him in the spiritual world. So that's the main reason. By coming and performing wonderful acts, then he's actually rejuvenating the process of Shravana and Kirtana. In other words, he's giving us topics to speak about him. Imagine if you wouldn't have any narration about Krishna. Even if you want to remember Krishna, how can you remember someone that we don't know what is his name, what he does, where does he live? We know nothing about him, so how can we think about him? So Krishna comes and he enacts so many pastimes. And these pastimes, they are the life and soul for those who try to remember Krishna and try to go back to Godhead. Later on, Srimad Bhagavatam, the gopis, feeling separation from Krishna, after losing his sight in the rasa dance, they will speak a very famous verse, saying, Tava katamritam tapta jivanam, kaviberiditam kalma shapaham, shravana mangalam shrimadatatam buvigrinanti e buridajana. They say that Krishna, your pastimes, the topics about you, they are the nectar for those people who are burning in the fire of material existence. Shravana mangalam shrimadatatam, they are very beautiful and they are the most auspicious things for those who hear them. And the magnanimous souls, the great sages, they worship these topics, and the great souls who travel around the world speaking this message, they're the most magnanimous people. So this is the life of the devotees, is to hear about Krishna, to speak about Krishna, and to live a life according to Krishna's instructions. So this is what Prabhupada was doing. That was Prabhupada's life mission. That was his dedication to his spiritual master, to Krishna, was to actually go. He had been hearing that message from the beginning of his life. He had been living according to that message. And then he went to the West and he was spreading the message. But he knew that this message, even though it's very sweet, it's very beautiful, it's very attractive, it's a transcendental message, but it's not easy to make the conditioned souls hear about Krishna and what to speak of, follow the instructions of Krishna, what to speak of going back to Godhead. It's not an easy task, because the tendency of the conditioned soul is to forget Krishna. And the duty of Maya, the whole business of Maya, is to keep us distracted from Krishna. So Maya will provide unlimited topics, unlimited things for us to hear in this material world. If you want to hear about any material topic, no, you can turn on the TV, you can get so many books about material topics, you can just turn on the internet, and you have unlimited supply of material news. So to compete with that and to be able to attract people to hear about Krishna is not an easy task. And Prabhupada knew that. It's not enough to just go to the West and speak about Krishna. So he needed a special strategy to actually be able to bring people to Krishna consciousness. And I was thinking about that and came one analogy to my mind. No? Imagine that someone has studied Ayurveda. Someone knows Ayurveda. And that person wants to go and teach Ayurveda to others so that they can get the benefit, no, of Ayurvedic medicine. So that person may go and give seminars and may travel all over the world speaking about the glories of Ayurveda. But that's not really enough to help people get relief from the material pains, from the suffering that they are having from the diseases. Just go and speak about is not going to solve the problem. But suppose that person, before going and speaking, that person writes a book about Ayurveda. So when he goes and speaks, first of all, people will give more credit and will trust what he says, because, wow, that person, he's an author of a book on Ayurveda, so he's an authority. So they'll hear more attentively, and not only that, after the seminar is finished, he can give the book, and the person can go deeper and study more about that and can apply in his own life. But even that is not sufficient, because a person who heard some class about Ayurveda and who bought a book, how much can they apply that if they don't have the proper guidance and the proper support system to apply that knowledge? So imagine that this person not only wrote a book or books about Ayurveda, not only traveled all over the world speaking about Ayurveda, but also opened many hospitals. And in those hospitals, he has trained doctors who can actually treat people and who can teach others Ayurveda. So if a person can do that kind of arrangement, then now he has the message, he has the books which keep that message in a more, constant way, because in Kali Yuga people cannot just hear and retain the information. So if you have a book, then you have the knowledge kept safe for future generations. And then also he has a system, a whole support system, that when someone wants to get the benefit from Ayurveda, they can come to the hospital, they can get the treatment, they can get lessons on Ayurveda from others who have studied it before. So that is a very substantial arrangement. And I was thinking that's what Prabhupada did. Prabhupada translated the books. Then he went all over the world preaching that message, and he established a society in which we have that message going on. And the whole point is that people can come to ISKCON, they can hear about Krishna, they can get access to Krishna Katha, no? And then not only that, but they can get the treatment also. They can learn how to practice Bhakti Yoga, and they can have a support system where other people are there practicing with them, and they can get instruction from those who are more experienced, and we can make arrangements to attract more and more people to actually get the same message. So what Prabhupada did is something very amazing. He's not just giving the message, he's creating a whole system to help more and more people to hear, to practice, and to become masters in that message, so that they can give to others. So this is something that we have to always try to keep in mind, because there's a tendency to forget and to somehow get misdirected and sometimes get involved in so many things. For example, to establish an institution which is necessary for keeping that message, to spread that message, to bring people and help them to practice, is not an easy task, because an institution requires money, requires land, requires buildings, requires so many things. But if we miss the point, if we focus on all those things, and then we forget the message, this is like we have the hospital, we have all the equipment, we have the people, we have everything, but the treatment is not going on. So that's a danger that happens. No, it's the other side of the issue. From one side, if you don't have the institution, we just have the message, it's very difficult to get that message across, to keep that message in human society, and to train people in that message. But on the other hand, if you have the institution, then you may get distracted by so many other things, managerial things and all the problems in maintaining the institution, in collecting funds, and then the message may be neglected, may become a small part of the whole thing. And people come and they may not be able to see, okay, where is that message that I came looking for? So the preachers, they actually need to have places in which devotees are living that message very nicely. I had some experience of preaching in places where ISKCON was not very developed. And my main challenge was that, okay, you go there and you speak about Bhagavad Gita, about Srimad Bhagavatam, and people get inspired, they think, wow, that's so great, this message really makes sense, no, it's a great philosophy, so I want to go and see. Please show me a place where people are living this, and I want to see how it works. And then sometimes you don't know what to say, because nearby you don't know of any ISKCON center, of any place where you have devotees actually applying that knowledge in a way that would inspire people. So that's a big challenge for preachers. Sometimes you have to say, look, no, you may have to go to India, or you may have to go to some community far away to actually see some devotees who are trying to live this message. And then many people, they get discouraged in that process, because they cannot see the practical result and the practical application of the message. So it's actually a very... There's two sides of it. No, there is one side is the message itself. Someone has to be speaking about that message, traveling around the world and sharing the message of Srimad Bhagavad Gita. And on the other hand, you need to have places in which people are living that message, so that you can prove, okay, this is the you can judge the tree by the fruit. Palena parichyate. So when you can combine these two things, then the preaching becomes very powerful. And that can happen both in the individual level and in the institutional level. In the individual level, we can study Prabhupada's books, we can study these books in the association of devotees, and then we can become very serious in trying to practice and apply everything that we read in our own lives. And then when we meet people, we can share. And if we are actually practicing that, then when we speak, then that will be effective. Because we are practicing, so people can see in our own lives, they see, oh, this person is actually a very nice person, his life is exemplary, so I want to listen to what he has to say. And similarly, in the institutional level, the ISKCON has to be a place where the Bhagavatam message is happening. Once I heard a lecture by Ravindra Swarup Prabhu, and he was making that point very strongly, that ISKCON is the arrangement Prabhupada made for the message of Srimad Bhagavatam to take place. Just speaking is not very fruitful, so you need a fertile place in which that message can actually happen, in which people can practice that message. So Prabhupada made an international arrangement, worldwide arrangement, for the message of Srimad Bhagavatam to take place, and that is ISKCON. And if you go through the purpose of ISKCON, the seven purposes of ISKCON, we can see that it's basically is a movement meant to educate people in spiritual life. So people have to come, they have to get that message, and they have to be trained in living according to that message, and they have to be trained in how to spread that message also. So like that, no, ISKCON is that kind of arrangement. So we have a place where people come, they hear Srimad Bhagavatam, and then not only they hear, but they see that everything that is going around is based on that philosophy. The way people are living, the way people are eating, the way they are dealing with each other, the way they are doing things, no? The way they are maintaining themselves, is all according to the principles of Srimad Bhagavatam. And then they can see that these people, they understand what they are doing, and they can explain, and they can clarify any doubt that I have. So if you have that kind of society, the preaching will be very powerful. If you don't have that, it's a big challenge to preach. A big challenge. Some time ago, I had my parents coming to Mayapur to visit me and my family, because I just had a child, and then a small baby, you know, they came to see the grandchild. And for many years, for 15 years, my father has been hearing from me about Vedic culture, about Srimad Bhagavatam, about Bhagavad Gita, and he himself reads. He read many of Prabhupada's books, and he's always interested in knowing more about everything connected to what I do. So once he went to a seminar on Ayurveda in Brazil, and once he was interested in architecture, in Vastu Shastra, and how, you know, all the because he came to India first many years ago when I was living in Vrindavan, and he visited many places, and he was very impressed with the Vedic architecture. He saw some palaces in Jaipur and places like that, and he was very intrigued, because he said, I never saw in Europe or anywhere this kind of construction. All the castles in Europe, they cannot compare to the palaces that he saw there in Jaipur, for example, to the Taj Mahal. So he was very impressed, and he wanted to know about Vastu Shastra and Vedic architecture. So like that, no, he was very, he's a person who likes to read and who likes a lot to know about things. So, but after 15 years, hearing about the glories of the Vedic civilization and how the Vedas, they deal with so many topics in wonderful ways, no? Then he came to Mayapur and he told me, I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed because I live in Gornagar, then my father was looking around, he said, I don't see the Vedic Vastu Shastra principles being applied. I don't see the Vedic palaces that I heard about, and I don't see a Vedic city developing here. That seems worse than what I see in the West. So he was disappointed from that. And then he said, you have so much science of Ayurveda and this and that, but no, you need treatment for your baby and for your wife, and you have to go to another city, and you have to go to Western medicine, and where is your doctor? Where is your hospital? Where is your arrangement? How can you show to the world that you have an arrangement that is superior to what they know? No, I cannot see that here. So I had to explain to him that's actually a very new society is developing. Now we have so much to, a long way to run, to go. But I was very thoughtful after that, no? Because he was joking at me. He was saying, look, no, you have so much philosophy, but when your child is sick, you have to run to the Christian nuns in Krishnanagar to get help from them. Why can't you go to a Vedic doctor? Why don't you have that in Mayapur itself, in your Vedic city? And he was making jokes like that. And he's a well-wisher. He likes Prabhupada, he likes Prabhupada's books. He appreciates so much our philosophy. But he was making points that I had to understand, that actually he has a point here. We have a lot of things to develop. So anyway, my point is not to discourage anyone, but my point is to see that we need to show to the world in practice that we know how to apply the philosophy. It's not easy, but that's what Prabhupada wanted. Prabhupada didn't want just to give a message. He wanted to give a message, he wanted to give books, and he wanted to establish a society in which people can see that this message actually works. So like that, no? And if we can do these three things, if we can learn the message, if we can apply that message in our life and in our society, and if we can spread that message to the world, then we'll be doing a great service to Srila Prabhupada and for the benefit of the whole human society. So that's my message for the beginning of Chandaniyatra. It's, we see Krishna there dressed in wonderful ways in the altar. And that is very meaningful. If you have heard about him enough, and if you have been absorbed in his pastimes. So you can even try it these days, no? Before you come to the temple to take darshan, to think about that particular pastime that is going to be depicted there, to read something about, no? And in this way, try somehow to be ready to see Krishna when the darshan opens. Okay, so I will stop the class here. If anybody wants to add anything with some comments or ask any question, then you have some time. Yes, Gandhi. Natavara. Okay, so Ganga Mataji is asking if I know any story about Natavara, because today Krishna is going to be dressed as the best of all dancers. So I think it's not only one story, but there are so many stories about Krishna dancing. I can just briefly mention some of them. Well, everybody knows about the Rasa dance. You know, he's famous that he's dancing in a wonderful way that each gopi can dance with Krishna simultaneously. At the same time, Krishna is expanding himself in so many ways, and he can dance with everybody, all the gopis at the same time. And he's the best dancer. So that's a famous pastime. There is another one, a little less famous, but equally wonderful, which is Krishna dancing with the peacocks. So once Krishna was trying to pacify Radharani, he was very angry. And he's trying so many things, no, but he couldn't pacify her. So finally some peacocks, I'm just making it very short, no? But some peacocks were there dancing, and then Krishna started dancing with the peacocks in a kind of transcendental competition of dance. And when Radharani saw that, then she became very amused to see Krishna dancing with the peacocks. And all the gopis were having so much fun by seeing Krishna dancing, and all the peacocks also dancing, and Krishna would dance, and the peacocks would dance, and then Krishna would dance again. And then the gopis were laughing like anything, and they said, Krishna, you are dancing very nicely, but the peacocks are better. So Krishna didn't accept that. No? So he started again and dancing and spinning and doing so many wonderful moves. And then after some time, the gopis applauded and said, Krishna, you are surpassing your own dancing talent. You are doing a great dance, but still the peacocks are better. So like that, no, Krishna is trying. He's doing so many things. And finally, in the end, Radharani is so happy that she also starts dancing. Radha and Krishna, they dance, and the peacocks dance. And there's a whole, no, it's such a nice, happy mood and wonderful pastime of dancing. So, and they dress like peacocks and peahen, and it's very amazing. And this pastime was actually seen by a saint who was blind. So he couldn't see with the eyes, but he could see in his heart. And he depicted that, he painted in the paintings there in Varshana, there is a Morkutir, is a temple of the peacock, and there is a painting, and that painting was made by that Vaishnava who was a saint and who was blind. So that's a proof that the darshan of Krishna is not through the eyes, it's by hearing about him, by thinking about him, and then Krishna can reveal himself in the heart of the devotee. So like that, there are so many pastimes of dancing, and today Krishna will be dancing there, Radha Madhava will be dressed as the best of dancers. And yes, thank you Ganga Mataji for that connection. Any other questions or comments? Okay, Kusha Prabhu.
Krishna was dancing to pacify Srimati Radharani. So when devotees have misunderstanding, like couples, why do they have to invite family members, authority? Why don't you just dance for your wife to pacify her?
Okay, so you're trying to see the practical application of that in our lives, yeah? So Krishna pacified Radharani by dancing. So why the couples, the husband cannot pacify the wife, find ways to pacify the wife, and they go for what for? Counseling. Yeah? Mm. Why do the husbands, why can't the husbands do the same, no? Well, first of all, the husbands, they are far, far distant from Krishna. They are not like Krishna. And the wives are not like Radharani. So there's a huge difference, no? And also, there's a lot about training. No, we were speaking about philosophy, that we have so much philosophy. How to deal with everyone. Srimad Bhakti is all about relationship. We see Krishna dealing with his devotees. We see the devotees dealing among themselves. The whole Srimad Bhakti and Chaitanya Charitamrita, we can say there's a three types of relationship. Bhagavatam is Rasa Malayam. Krishna is Akila Rasamrita Murti. So that rasa is nothing but the sweetness which comes out of transcendental relationships. So the whole Bhagavatam is teaching us how to relate to Krishna and how to relate to each other. The whole Chaitanya Charitamrita is doing the same. We see how the devotees deal. So the thing is that we have a lot of philosophy. But when it comes to practice, we have a lot of homework to do. So even in husband and wife relationship, if we would follow the Vedic standard of relationship, if we would know how to deal, the wife would know how to deal with the husband would know how to deal with the wife, then life could be much more peaceful. That's a fact. So the challenge is that we're not actually able to apply many of the things that we read in the books. So that gap between the philosophy and the practice is very big in ISKCON yet, still, because it's a new society. So it will take some time, and we have to work hard in actually learning how to apply those principles in our lives. And the moment we apply, then it works. I have very little experience because, first of all, I have been married only for 3 years, and also because my wife is very peaceful. She never shouts, she never fights. So I don't have much experience in having to pacify my wife. But once I had to do it, once she was very angry, and then that was the only solution. I had no one to ask help. Actually, we're traveling in Brazil, and we are in a farm far away, actually, so I think 5 hours from the nearest city. And she was so angry. So I had to take shelter in Krishna and Srimad Bhagavatam and think, how can I solve that problem? And then, just don't have to go into the details, but I was thinking, Krishna, Radha Madhava, what can I do, no? And then I saw she was so angry that she actually took out the bangles, the marriage bangles, and she threw them away. So I didn't know what to do. So I thought for quite a while, and I was chanting and thinking about Krishna and asking help. And then finally, Radha Madhava gave the solution. I came to her and said, Medha, I know you're very angry. You don't want to speak with me. You don't want to see my face. But some time ago, we promised in front of Radha Madhava that we're going to be together. So I just ask you one thing. For the moment, for the time being, you put back your bangles. We're going back to India, and we reach Mayapur, then you go and you do whatever you like. But you go in front of Radha Madhava first, and you tell them that you want to take out your bangles and you don't want to see me anymore. Then it's fine. But until we go in front of them, because we promised to them, so until we go to Radha Madhava and speak to them, you please keep your bangles on. And then that solved the problem. By the time you came back to Mayapur, it was all fine. So anyway, that's the thing. No, we have to actually learn how to take shelter of Krishna, how to apply the philosophy in our lives. And it's not easy. It requires a lot of surrender, a lot of prayer, a lot of introspection. It's a big challenge. So thank you, Kusha Prabhu, for your observation. Anybody else would like to ask anything or comment? Yes, Prabhu?
Thank you, Krishna Prabhu. The 5,000, now also so many Matajis are praying like a husband, like Krishna, I want Krishna as a husband, the praying. Prabhuji also can pray like Radharani, they're serving Lord Krishna nicely, so that we want same quality they're expecting. No, that is good. Prabhuji?
Okay, so you're saying that someone may pray that I want a husband like Krishna, or may pray that I want a wife like Radharani. Yeah? Is that good? So I would say it's better that we ask a husband who is a devotee of Krishna, we ask a wife who is a devotee of Krishna, like that, because the conditioned soul has the tendency to imitate Krishna, and that's why you are here in the material world. And we want, if I am a man, I project my ideal of woman, which is actually Radharani, she's the ideal woman. I project that ideal of a woman in some limited conditioned soul who can never compare to Radharani, or can never compare to Krishna. But I imagine, somehow by my illusion, I project that ideal on a woman, or the woman project that ideal on a man. And they imagine that, oh, this woman is just like Radharani, this man is just like Krishna. And then they get married. But very soon they realize that actually he's not like Krishna, and she's not like Radharani. And then they'll be so disappointed. And then there is the tendency of divorce. So this is what we call the romantic marriage. You just fall in love with someone, you think, oh, this person is so amazing, so great, he's the most wonderful, he's my Krishna, she's my Radha, and that's a great illusion. And then when it fades away, then divorce. So that's like a big fire when it starts. No? You fall in love with someone, you want to marry that person, you think he's the most wonderful person, but just like when you put fire in a straw, and the straw burns very quickly, and then it's finished. But the Vedic style of marriage is different. It's like Kardama and Devahuti. So Kardama Muni, he's a great devotee. That's his qualification. And in Devahuti, she's also a great devotee and very faithful wife. So it's very interesting because both of them, they're not expecting that the other will be Krishna or Radha. They are simply trying to practice devotional service together. And by doing that, both of them, they achieve Krishna as their son and they go back to Godhead. So that's the thing. It's not about looking at each other as if Radha and Krishna, but try to serve Radha and Krishna together. So real relationship in this material world is not looking at each other, thinking, oh, you're so great. It's actually both together looking at Radha and Krishna and walking together trying to serve them. So you have to follow in the footsteps of the devotees in Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, and try to be like them in their married life. Okay? Thank you, Prabhu. Any other question or comments? Kushpa?
You mentioned Kanapa Muni and Devahuti. And you said we should follow the full step of devotees in Srimad Bhagavatam. Before Kanapa Muni accepted Devahuti, he told the father, I will leave her after I give her my car. It was an agreement. So Devahuti knew that tomorrow this man will leave me. Devahuti knew that tomorrow. If you must follow the example of people in Bhagavatam, if you must follow the example of people in Bhagavatam, why don't we make it known in the beginning that tomorrow I will divorce you?
Make it known in the beginning that
because Karamuni told that to Devahuti and his father and her father. Tomorrow I will leave her. So she knew.
So the point
so
is,
we need in devotees when people get engaged, get married, they don't promise each other tomorrow
so
I will leave you.
So
I will live with you forever.
When people get engaged,
a few years they divorce.
That's not a very good thing.
Kalamamuni told Devahuti, I will leave you after I give you a son. So she knew that tomorrow the man will go.
So your question, why Niskon?
Because you say we should follow the people in Bhagavata.
Yeah, we should.
So why don't we tell them we divorce you tomorrow?
Yeah, so In the West, when people get married, they make a promise to stay together until death separates them. That's not the Vedic standard. The Vedic standard is different. No, we know what's the standard. We know that the goal of life is self-realization. It's not just to find a nice couple and have a happy married life. That's not the goal of life. So we know that. So we have to apply. So how do we apply? You have to actually learn and to develop that culture. So that we can. So the difficulty is that nowadays we don't have that culture established. So you tell a wife to be a good Vedic wife, but if the husband is not trained to be a proper husband, then she's going to have a hard time. And the children and the teenagers, because there is no culture established, they're also going to have a hard time, even if they want to be good and to apply that Vedic culture, because the culture is not established. So if one person tries to apply alone, it's very difficult.
Not established.
Because you require the support of the whole community. If someone wants to be a good father, a good mother, a good son, a good anything, but he's alone doing that, then it's difficult. Imagine a wife, she wants to be good, she wants to follow the example of Srimad Bhagavatam, but the husband is doing everything wrong. He's not giving her the protection that she needs. Then she may, if she's a hero, she's a great soul, she may still be able to do that, even if the husband is a rascal. But it's going to be very difficult. On the other hand, if you have a husband who is trained properly, a wife who is trained properly, and you have example from the parents who already did it properly, so it's very easy for everyone. It's very easy to do something that you saw, oh, my father did like that, my mother did like that. It's not a big deal. So if my father did, why can't I do the same? Right? But if you see, my father never did any of these things. He's just telling me to do. Then it's very difficult. So the point of coming to 50 years old and going to the forest, that's the Vedic injunction. So that means at 50, we should have come to a point that we are changing the direction of our lives. Until 50, we may be trying to prosper, to develop a business, to develop the family, to make children, to make a house, right? But the moment you are 50, the injunction is you have to stop that, and you have to dedicate yourself to spiritual life. So you stop trying to increase your business, stop making children, stop all these things. Now is the opposite process. It's a process of detaching yourself from all these things. It may not be immediately. That's why there is Vanaprastha stage in which you can gradually become detached from these things. And then when you're ready, then there is sannyas. So all that, we know that it's there, but why we don't see many people practicing? Because the culture is not established, and therefore it's very difficult. But when we can practice it to be great, we need so much to have good brahmacharis, good grihasthas, good vanaprasthas, and good sannyasis. That will make a very strong society. So it's true. Okay? Thank you, Prabhu. Any other question? So, all glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Chandaniyatra Mahamahotsava ki jai.